Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Australia decides to launch airstrikes against militants in Iraq. Chinese officials react to Hong Kong protests. Britain's prime minister visits Afghanistan. Transition becomes the key word for foreign forces in that country. And the U.S. drops its ban on weapons sales to Vietnam. These stories and more all ahead on International Edition. Sitting in today for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest. The Australian government has authorized airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Iraq. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says IS has declared war on the world and must be degraded and disrupted. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australian warplanes are expected to begin bombing missions inside Iraq within days. Canberra has already sent 600 troops and six fighter jets to a US base in the United Arab Emirates. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says Australian commandos will be deployed to northern Iraq to act as advisers to local forces fighting insurgents. Critics worry that Australia will become enmeshed in another protracted war in the Middle East. But Mr. Abbott insists military action will make the nation safer.
It is in everyone's best interests that the murderous rage of the ISIL death cult be checked and rolled back, and that's what we're determined to do. ISIL has declared war on the world. ISIL is launching an assault on civilization, not just upon the people of Iraq right now.
The United States and Arab nations have been bombing IS targets in Iraq and Syria for some 2 weeks. More than 60 nations are now involved in the US-led mission, although most aren't carrying out airstrikes. European nations involved in the air campaign are only hitting targets in Iraq. The combat operation has the support of Australia's main opposition Labour Party. Its leader Bill Shorten says that military action alone can't drain the swamp of terrorism, and longer-term stability depends on the government of Iraq and its people. However, Greens leader Christine Milne believes that Australia's military action in the Middle East will increase the risk of terrorism at home. Milne accuses the Abbott government of taking Australia into a multi-year quagmire in Iraq. About 60 Australians are thought to have joined extremist groups in Iraq and Syria, and Canberra has raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high. In recent weeks, counter-terrorism raids have been carried out in Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne. New laws have been introduced to the Australian Parliament, giving the authorities greater powers to combat the threat of homegrown extremism. Last month, a teenage terror suspect was shot dead by police in Melbourne after two officers were stabbed. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Moderate Syrian rebel field commanders are saying the U.S.-led air offensive in Syria is actually helping President Bashar al-Assad. Jamie Detmer reports from the Turkish-Syrian border.
Abu Mohammed, a moderate Islamist field commander, is in no doubt about his disapproval of U.S. strategy in Syria. He warns that the US-led coalition against the jihadists of the Islamic State is in effect bolstering Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He says the Syrian president has taken the opportunity of the coalition airstrikes to refocus his forces, shifting some of them from eastern Syria, where they were fighting the jihadists, and reinforcing his own offensive against moderate and Islamist rebels in a key city of Aleppo. He says Syrian government airstrikes on Aleppo the past 2 days have increased in tempo and are terrifying. A former colonel in the Syrian army, Abu Mohammed, he says he defected after his superiors ordered him to shoot civilians, is now a top commander in the Syrian Revolutionaries Front. The SRF, an Islamist brigade that has fought alongside the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate, also targeted by American warplanes, says the rebels are at a disadvantage now in Aleppo. Once Syria's prosperous commercial capital, Aleppo has been seen as some of the most vicious fighting of the nearly four-year-long civil war, and about half of it is under rebel control. But since recapturing Homs, Syria's third-largest city, several months ago, Mr. Assad has redoubled his efforts to regain total control of Aleppo, the loss of which would be devastating for the rebels. He says both Islamic State and Mr. Assad are taking positions from the rebels. Abu Abdullah, another commander with the SRF, says the Islamic State group is hard to fight, and the tanks and weapons they captured from fleeing Iraqi units around Mosul several months ago, when the jihadists launched an offensive in Iraq, are now being used against the rebels in Syria. He says the Islamic State fighters are coming from all over the world, but the jihadist field commanders he's battling tend to be Chechens or Gulf Arabs. Another rebel fighter from a brigade called the Lions of Tawid also says he's disappointed that the American-led coalition is not targeting Assad forces. Assad is the head of the snake and should be cut off, he says. US officials say their first priority is to degrade and defeat the Islamic State group in both Iraq and Syria, as it represents a global threat. The Obama administration is planning to screen 5,000 Syrian rebels and train them in Saudi Arabia. Some rebels say they're not interested in joining such a force, as it would take them away from the battlefield. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kilis.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan to hold talks with the leaders of that country's new unity government. Mr. Cameron met President Ashraf Ghani at the presidential palace in the capital Kabul Friday morning for talks. During a news conference following the meeting, Mr. Cameron said Britain will continue to support the development of the Afghan forces despite its bringing home of all of its combat troops by the end of the year.
We want an Afghanistan that is no longer a safe haven for terrorists or a threat to the security of either of our countries. And today, we've discussed how we can keep working together to achieve those goals.
Britain currently has close to 3,000 troops in Afghanistan as part of the NATO force. Transition is the key word for NATO-led international forces in Afghanistan as the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, continues to draw down its troops on the ground. As the number of international troops dwindles, the top commander of those forces in Afghanistan says the fight is still a difficult one. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports.
Chaos after the latest Taliban suicide bombing in Kabul. This one killed three Afghan officers and wounded seven others. ISAF Commander General John Campbell says the toll of Afghan forces killed and wounded this year is between 7 and 9,000, slightly higher than last year. Speaking to reporters via satellite, he says recent fighting in Helmand province has contributed to the rise.
The last couple of weeks, there's been an uptick with the Taliban trying to make a statement as they close out the fighting season.
As Afghan forces shoulder more fighting responsibilities, ISAF troops will draw down from about 40,000 to less than 13,000 in Afghanistan at the end of December. Analyst Andrew Wilder says that means a new role for international forces.
It's important to emphasize that the main mission is not a combat mission. It's again, this training, advising, and assisting mission.
But Campbell warns international forces still have a difficult road ahead.
We lost a soldier the other night. We lost three about 5 days ago. So this continues to be a very tough environment for our soldiers, for all of NATO.
Campbell told VOA that while international forces are no longer on patrol with Afghan brigades, they are still battling to rid the country of al-Qaeda insurgents through counterterrorism, or CT, operations. Even as more troops leave, General Campbell says he is comfortable that international forces are on the right path to helping build a more stable Afghanistan. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Listen to Today in History, weekdays on The Voice of America, following International Edition. Hong Kong police intervened today when street fights broke out between pro-democracy demonstrators and residents who opposed the protests. No serious injuries reported. The official China National Tourism Administration is barring mainland tour groups from traveling to Hong Kong. Wednesday's edict marks a strategic shift in the way the government in Beijing is attempting to deal with democracy protests that are growing by the day in Hong Kong. Ivan Broadhead has more.
More than 40 million mainlanders cross the border into Hong Kong each year, by far the city's largest group of visitors. Travel Industry Council Executive Director Joseph Tung says while non-Chinese tourists are opting to stay away from Hong Kong at this sensitive time, Wednesday's announcement is a blow for the local tourism sector.
The number of groups is around 300 a day. But according to the information we receive, although this is not confirmed, because we do not have the confirmed document from mainland China agent, they receive instruction that they are going to stop promoting tours to Hong Kong.
Professor Michael DeGolia, director of the Hong Kong Transition Project, forecast the ban just hours before it became public. It forms part of what he calls the anaconda scenario, this slow strangulation of the Hong Kong democracy movement. The slump in the tourist trade will lead to service sector job cuts, perhaps as early as next week. Pressure on the Hong Kong dollar and the potential delisting of companies from the Hang Seng stock market as global confidence falters in the local economy.
The objective or strategy of this movement is to increasingly turn the population against the students and the leaders of Occupy Central because of this slowly increasing economic pain. And so there are various ways, without going back to tear gas and using force, of increasing the pressure on students and supporters of Occupy Central to begin to back down.
Out on the streets, the activists, weary but resolute, express their solidarity with the Hong Kong people, but remain unmoved by Beijing's action. Many view the move as just another attempt by China to keep news about the democracy movement from seeping back across the border. Besides, tourism contributes less than 5% to Hong Kong gross domestic product, and only 30% of Chinese visitors arrive in organized tour parties anyway, says activist Bernard Luck, who is resting atop a barricade with friends.
When mainland tourists come down to Hong Kong, they spend most of their money on luxury hotels, Gucci handbags, iPhones, that sort of high-end products, which obviously contributes to the Hong Kong economy, but not directly. Do you get what I mean? All those money goes back to, you know, for example, the Gucci and Apple, and it will have a very, very small impact on grassroots. Yes.
If Beijing chose, it could impose a far harsher economic punishment on citizens of its semi-autonomous region, which is largely dependent on the mainland for food and water supplies. De Gaulle describes this as the Sun Tzu scenario after the author of The Art of War.
They really wanted to make Hong Kong surrender without firing a shot, they could simply say, okay, we're going to give you complete autonomy. No water, no mainland transport, no ships, no aircraft. And after a week to 10 days, begin asking, well, just how much autonomy do you want?
While the strategizing in Beijing continues, the standoff between authorities and the protesters becomes more intractable. And with each passing day, the next generation of Hong Kong citizens becomes increasingly disenchanted with its nation's leaders. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
The United States is urging authorities and demonstrators in Hong Kong to engage in dialogue to end the protests that have choked Hong Kong thoroughfares for the past week. VOA State Department spokesman Pam Dawkins reports.
The State Department says the U.S. continues to maintain its open line of communication with China. Spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the U.S. wants both sides to exercise caution and pursue ways to resolve the dispute.
We would certainly be concerned if there is an escalation by authorities. We will see what happens, but we continue to encourage that and urge restraint in all of our conversations.
She commented on Thursday, a day after Secretary of State John Kerry and his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi held talks on a wide range of issues, including the protest. During a joint appearance with Kerry, China's foreign minister, speaking through an interpreter, made it clear that any outside interference in the unrest would not be welcomed.
Hong Kong affairs are China's internal affairs. All countries should respect China's sovereignty. And this is also a basic principle governing international relations.
China considers the protests illegal. Police have warned of serious consequences if demonstrators try to surround or occupy buildings. Psaki would not say if an escalation in the use of force against the pro-democracy demonstrators would result in a shift of U.S.-China policy.
I'm just not going to get ahead of where we are. Certainly, we hope that is not the case.
The White House says President Barack Obama has also underscored U.S. hopes for a peaceful resolution of the standoff. The issue could receive more attention when the president opens a three-day visit to Beijing next month. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
The United States has partially lifted a decades-long ban on lethal weapons sales to Vietnam, a move that comes nearly four decades after the end of the Vietnam War. The U.S. State Department Thursday described the move as allowing for the future transfer of maritime security-related military hardware to its former foe. Police in Thailand say two men from Myanmar have confessed to last month's killing of a British couple who were vacationing on a southern island. The bodies of 23-year-old Hannah Witheridge and 24-year-old David Miller were found in September. Texas authorities are taking measures to prevent the spread of Ebola after the virus sickened a Liberian visitor to the city of Dallas. Four people he was visiting have been quarantined in their apartment and will be monitored for fever and other Ebola symptoms. Health officials are checking local schools to make sure they are safe. Zlatika Hoke reports the first U.S. diagnosed Ebola case is sparking fear that the virus might spread in the United States.
Authorities in Dallas, Texas have ordered power washing of the apartment complex where Thomas Eric Duncan, the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States, stayed last month before he became sick. Officials are investigating the circumstances surrounding Duncan's infection.
We only know that he apparently arrived here, I believe, on the 20th in the United States, and his symptoms did not begin until about the 24th.
Duncan is in isolation at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. When he was first rushed to an emergency room, he was diagnosed with a mild fever and returned home, only to return seriously ill a few days later. He was hospitalized after testing positive for Ebola. Duncan's nephew, Joe Weeks, who lives in North Carolina, told reporters Thursday that his uncle remains in serious condition.
He was here to see his son. He came for his graduation. Unfortunately, he missed the graduation, so he hasn't seen his son yet.
Health authorities want to interview about 100 people who may have been in contact with Duncan. The news has sparked fear among parents with children in local schools.
I'm trying to see what kind of safety precautions they're taking at the school for me to determine whether or not, you know, my child is going to be able to return.
The fear is not limited to Dallas. Microbiologist Gil Mobley protested at the Atlanta airport Thursday against what he sees as a lack of adequate precaution against Ebola. He says U.S. health authorities have underestimated the potential of importing Ebola cases to the United States.
Once this disease consumes every third world country, as surely it will, because they lack the same basic infrastructure as Sierra Leone and Liberia, it will devour these countries. And at that point, we will be importing clusters of Ebola on a daily basis.
Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea are among the West African countries hardest hit by Ebola. More than 3,300 patients have died since the outbreak started in March, nearly 2,000 of them in Liberia, where Duncan came from. Health officials say air travel does not play a role in spreading Ebola.
Ebola is not an airborne disease. Ebola is transmitted by contact of sick person, and the transmission is done by the body fluid.
The Obama administration is sending 3,000 troops to Liberia to help contain the disease. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said her government will investigate whether Duncan knew that he might have been in contact with a sick person before traveling to the United States. Larissa Ho, VOA News, Washington.
The Associated Press reports that an American cameraman working for NBC News in Liberia has come down with Ebola. The network says its entire crew in Liberia, including correspondent Dr. Nancy Snyderman, will be flown back to the U.S. and placed in quarantine. The freelance cameraman had worked in Liberia for 3 years and will receive treatment in the United States. The journalists were covering the Ebola epidemic. Pneumonia is a leading cause of death worldwide. The bacterial infection kills one person every 10 seconds, according to experts who say they have discovered how the pathogen behaves so they can better develop treatments. VOA's Jessica Berman has our report.
The bacterium that causes pneumonia, Streptococcus pneumoniae, can behave in 6 different unique ways. One version causes the severe lung disease, which can kill in a matter of days. The pneumonia bacterium can also cause sinusitis, or inflammation of the sinus passages, lethal blood infections, meningitis, and infections of the middle ear. But sometimes the bacterium is spread harmlessly among people without them getting sick. Marco Oggioni is a bacterial geneticist at the University of Leicester in Britain. Writing in the journal Nature Communications, he and an international team of researchers describe what they call a genetic switch that allows the bacterium to cause any of those 6 different infections. He says young children are particularly vulnerable to a lethal infection.
It's a very acute disease and it's a very fast disease, and so often children arrive late to hospitals.
Modern antibiotics can successfully treat a pneumococcal infection, but time is of the essence, according to Oggioni. That is why it's important to know the exact bacterial form that is causing illness.
By understanding how this bacterium behaves, especially in the very severe cases, that we could maybe give new guidelines or ways for treatment.
Oggioni says being able to identify the correct face of this unpredictable microbe would allow doctors to treat patients with the most effective antibiotic and could help researchers develop targeted vaccines against Streptococcus pneumoniae. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The Associated Press reports authorities in Israel are on high alert, hoping to avert violence between Muslims and Jews, as both religions observe major holidays. This year, the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur overlaps with the Islamic observance of Eid al-Adha. Police are braced for a possible breakdown, or breakout, rather, of sectarian violence. Well, thank you for joining us on International Edition today. By the way, you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Check it out. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day. This is Today in History. On October 3rd, 1990, a divided Germany was reunited as one nation, 45 years after the Allies carved it up at the end of World War II. The reunification of East and West Germany ended what had come to serve as one of the most enduring symbols of the Cold War. On this day in 1932, Iraq became an independent state, ending 17 years of British rule mandated by the League of Nations. The British departure from Iraq gave way to a brief constitutional monarchy, but failure to control ethnic violence created a political void in Iraq that was soon filled by a series of military coups. On this day in 1993, the Battle of Mogadishu, a street battle dramatized by Hollywood in the movie Black Hawk Down, a U.S.-led operation designed to capture local militia leaders in downtown Mogadishu, Somalia, went awry, resulting in the deaths of 18 U.S. soldiers and more than 1,000 Somalis. The event prompted President Clinton to eventually withdraw from the U.N.'s mission in Somalia 6 months later, and made him reluctant to use military intervention in a subsequent African conflict in Rwanda a year later. Folk singer and songwriter Woody Guthrie died on this day in 1967.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, and the California to the New York Island.
Guthrie lived through some of the most significant social and political upheavals of the 20th century, and he absorbed it all to become a prolific writer whose songs captured the plight of average people in America. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
I'm Ira Melman with an invitation for you to come and visit the American Cafe. It's a place where you can come and get a taste of America, from the bitter to the sweet. This past week, the United States recognized some mistakes it had made in the past.
Some of these soldiers fought and died for a country that did not always see them as equal.
For some in the Asian American communities, some stereotypes, although positive, are not always helpful.
What ends up happening is that we don't see what problems actually exist under the surface.
And then there are those who put it all on the line at a very popular festival in the capital city of Texas.
I don't know what to do with my life, but I really, 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 really want to be famous.
Come and visit the American Cafe. We have a new program for you every week. You can hear it on the radio, on the web, or iTunes, or at voanews.com. Come join us. No reservation necessary.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Most recently, he has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.